gentlemen, and welcome to all. My name is Debbie, and I am an alcoholic. Our fifth edition states that our primary purpose is to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's outstanding speaker of the week. I'm going to do my own introduction. I'm going to allow our speaker to give you his sobriety date. I know he thinks I forgot when his birthday is, but I don't. And, you know, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told to find the old-timers and stick with the winners. You know, and I walked into AA in 1996, a scared little girl, and I did that suggestion. I don't know why. I guess God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I'm not used to taking suggestions. But I'm glad I did. The speaker tonight, holds a very special place in my heart, and he always will. I've learned a lot from him, probably more than he even realizes. And with having said that, can I have the envelope, please, for the speaker of the week? You know, it's an honor and it's a privilege to be able to introduce tonight's speaker. And tonight, our speaker of the week is Jim Kay from Visalia. I knew you didn't know I knew.
I told you.
No, you didn't. You wouldn't tell me. I already know. You're doing my
job. All right. Hey, I'm not used to this stage thing, and I've only been a speaker twice in all the time I've been sober, so bear with me here. I made all these notes because I'm old, and I've been sober so long I can't remember everything at once. So I worked on this all week long. It was 35 years ago on this very night, July 25th, that I had my last drink. Now, tomorrow's my birthday, and it's been a long journey, I'll tell you that. And the way I got this gig tonight was that Bill's been after me for 2.5 years to do this, and I just don't like stages and podiums. So I don't mind the podium at the Alano Club, that's all right, but I don't like being way up high. I have a fear of heights. But, so about 3 weeks ago, I was sitting out here because I come to this meeting, and Bill walked over and started talking to me, and it occurred to me that my birthday was coming up, and I said, Bill, I'll make a deal with you. I'll speak at the Wednesday night meeting if it falls on the 25th. So he looked at his phone and said, oh, it falls on the 25th. And I said, well, that's close enough. That was the last day I had a drink. And he says, but I've got another speaker for that night. And I said, let me call him and I'll see if I can get him to switch to a different night. And I said, no, that's not fair to him. He's all psyched up to do this thing, and it's not right. I'm in not any more special than he is. And so he said, all right. And the next week I came back, and he says, guess what? He said, the guy called me and asked if he could be moved to another date because he had another obligation. So guess what? So I'm stuck. Anyway, you know, whenever I share at meetings, if I have, you know, 15, 20 minutes or... But the only two other times I shared it as a formal speaker at a speaker meeting, I always start by telling what, you know, going back to my childhood and telling what led up to my taking my first drink, and then I told about all the things that happened to me in my drinking years, and by the time I get to the end of that, I'm out of time and I never get to tell my sober log. So I wrote this thing out, and I thought when I got done, it'd take me all 40 minutes just to read it. I mean, they're all one-liners, just things to pique my memory. So I decided I was going to pull a switcheroo here, and I'm just going to talk about my sober log. And if I have enough time left over, I can go back and touch on some things in my drinking years. But like I said, I got here on this very day, I had my last thing on this 35 years ago. I was the accounting manager of the Western Area Operations of a national company. Its headquarters were in the industrial park in Visalia. They moved me out here to help get a losing operation turned around. I had a department with 23 people reporting to me, four of them supervisors, and I was living in the Oak Tree Inn. I don't know where any of you are old enough to remember the Oak Tree Inn. It used to be over there by COS. The old part of the motel was built in the early 30s, and it was where all the addicts and the alcoholics lived. And there I was, living in there. It was $70 a month. Had a shelf along one wall, a queen-size bed, a refrigerator, a TV, and a dumpy bathroom and closet area. And I was there because I'd escaped from my alcoholic addict girlfriend about a month earlier. And there's long stories behind all these things, but I'm going to stick to my sober log here. And I was just a wreck. After I got sober, my boss told me that he had to call the corporate offices in Niles, Michigan every day to give them an update on what was happening to me. They had no idea I had a drinking problem. They thought I was having a mental breakdown. And he had to call them to give them an update on my status, because they were pretty sure I was going to end up in a mental institution or I was just going to split and run. And I had no knowledge of this. And like I'd like to say, if I'd been my own boss, I probably would have fired myself 3 years before. But I'd produced for them, strangely enough. I had a genius for what I did, I guess. The big thing was I could delegate everything. So, you know, and that last day, I was just madder than hell at my alcoholic addict girlfriend. I had no business being with her in the first place, but I was in love. She had her old hooks into me, and it took a spiritual experience to get me to leave her a month before and move into the Oak Tree. And I don't know why I was so mad at her. I was mad at her because she wouldn't behave. And if she'd only behaved, none of this would have happened. And, you know, I was in miserable condition. The way I describe myself is I was physically, mentally, emotionally, morally, socially, and spiritually a wreck. I was just in terrible condition. And I was so mad at her that on this very day, 35 years ago, that I made up my mind that the worst thing that I could do to her was to get sober. Because she tried and failed, and I was going to get sober because living well is the best revenge. And, you know, I was going to show her I could do it where she couldn't. And I had always thought that if I had enough motivation, if I got angry enough and I had enough motivation, I could quit drinking whenever I wanted. And right then I knew the time had come. I had what I needed to make the decision to get sober. So I put every ounce of willpower, anger, willpower, determination, everything I had left in me into stopping drinking that very night. And 3 hours later, I had to get up and go to AAA liquor store and buy a bottle. Not a big one, because I couldn't drink much anymore. And that just defeated me. I was overwhelmed with a sense of doom. I mean, just like, you know, I was done. I was And I was sitting in the chair in the motel room, and I was saying, God, what am I supposed to do now? And I was just sitting there wondering, and I just defeated, and I had what I won't use the name I use. For AA, I use a holy knowing experience. And it's like God talks to me. I can't hear him with my ears, but it's just as clear as if I can. I had a few of those experiences before, and it told me what to do. And there had been a guy at work coming into my office for a year telling me about getting talking to you. He was older than me. He was a line supervisor in the plant. And every about once a month, he'd come into my office and talk to me about getting sober. And for some reason, I kind of felt that maybe he suspected I had a problem. So this is the voice said to go the next day in the morning to go look Jack up and tell him that I needed help, that I had a drinking problem. And I finished what I was drinking, went to bed, and I got up. The first one of those experiences I had been 20 years before. I didn't do what it told me to do, and everything after that was just never worked out. So I knew better than to not follow these holy knowing experiences. So I went and I did that, and he took me out to lunch with a guy from the National Council of Alcoholism. And the guy says, well, how much can you drink anymore? And I said, I can't drink much. I don't understand it, but I can't drink much. And he said, well, how much? And I said, well, I have trouble choking down a six-pack of beer and maybe one of those little cans of Manhattans. And he says, well, you're in the terminal stages of alcoholism. And terminal ran loud and clear in my ears. It meant dead. And you know, and the example I use of how my drinking capacity had diminished over the last few years was a few months before I'd come home from work and my girlfriend and her doper friends would be all out in the yard drinking beer and smoking joints. And I wasn't a drug addict, but I'd go into the kitchen and I'd get out a tall can of beer. She was drinking the tall ones then. And halfway through that can of beer, I'd get that warm feeling you get, the one you drink for, and it would last about, you know, I tell her how beautiful she was and how much I was in love with her and all these nice things. And then on the second can of beer, halfway through that, she turned into a whore and a bitch, and she was cheating on me. And then halfway through the third can, I had to go upstairs and pass out. And I'd wake up at 9, and they'd all be laughing and having fun down there in the yard and still drinking and smoking dope, and I'd be hungover at 9 in the evening and laying up there madder than hell. So when I told him, you know, he said, well, you're in the terminal stages of alcoholism, and that impressed me. Now, when I came in here, and this is in my notes, I had five emotions. I'm kind of reluctant to explain these, but lust, anger, self-pity, loneliness, and depression. That was my emotional makeup at that point in time. I was lustful, I was angry because I wasn't getting any, and then I felt sorry for myself because I wasn't getting any, and then I was lonely because there was nobody around and no chance to get any. And then I get depressed about it. I talked a lot about that when I first got sober, and Dottie one day told me, she says, I think you're in the wrong program. She says, I think you need to be in Sex Addicts Anonymous. But people tolerated me. Now, that guy I went to from the National Council on Alcoholism, the first thing he did was start leafing through a notebook. And I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm finding you a sponsor. And he said, oh, here's one. He's an accountant just like you. And I said, I don't want an accountant for a sponsor. I always thought I was unhappy because I was an accountant. I wanted to be an artist. I said, so don't you want an artist? I mean, don't you have an artist in there? And he leafed through there and he We found Clive's name. No, it turned out Clive wasn't an artist at all. He just had some artwork in his home. But he said, Clive's your sponsor. And I said, well, how am I going to meet him? And he said, you just go to meetings until he shows up. He'll show up one day. So I went, you know, I went to meetings for 3 weeks. And then this guy comes in. He says, I'm Clyde. I'm an alcoholic. And I went up to him at the meeting. And I said, you're supposed to be my sponsor. And he said, what? And I said, they didn't tell you? He said, no. He said, well, we can try it if you want. So Clive became my sponsor. I mean, I didn't know AA didn't work that way. But what Jack did, he took me to my first AA meeting. And back then, there were only night meetings, and they were all from 8 o'clock to 9:30. There weren't any morning meetings. There weren't any noon meetings, and there were only 5 a week in Visalia. The other 2 nights, you had to go to Tulare, and fortunately, I didn't have a car because my girlfriend had the only car I owned, and she wasn't about to give it back. And there's a funny story about that too. I called the police department one night at midnight when I was drunk and told them my girlfriend wouldn't give my car back. And she says, "Well, it sounds like you didn't need a lawyer, not the police." And I'd been down at where she worked. She was a waitress down at the end of the morning, and in a place at the end of the morning. And I'd asked her for the keys, and she wouldn't give them back. I don't know how I got down there. I got home, though, and I was talking to the police department. And she says, well, I tell you what I'll do. You go back down to where your girlfriend's working, and I'll send 2 police officers down there. And maybe their presence will intimidate her into giving you your keys back. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me how drunk I was. And I had enough sense left in me to think, well, that's probably not a good idea. So I said, no, no. So I never got my car back. So there I was in the Oak Tree Inn, no car. I had to borrow my son's 10-speed bike to get around. I had to borrow a friend's truck to go grocery shopping on the weekend. I was riding my bike to meetings. I had $2,000 in the bank, but I didn't want to buy a car because I knew if the one that she had broke down, she'd come and want to borrow the new one I had, and I wouldn't be able to say no because I wouldn't get anything in the future if I did that. So I didn't buy a car for 5 months. I rode that bike and caught rides with people from AA. So, am I running out of time here? Yeah. This is still getting kind of long because I got all these stories. Anyway, there I was in the Oak Tree Inn, and now I had enough. My first big problem was I always started drinking right after work. And I drank till about midnight or so, till I was just about ready to pass out. And then I'd go back home and pass out. I mean, that was the way I lived my life. But the first big problem was that when I got off of work, I had nothing to do. And then when I went to meetings, meetings were fine. I was around sober people. And then when I came home, I was so afraid of going out, I had to have a discipline. So what I did for 2 weeks, I came home from work, I got on my bed and just laid there for meeting time. Got up, went to the meeting, came home and just stayed in bed till the next morning, then got up to work. And after 2 weeks of that, I thought, I can't live this way. I got to find something to do. This is not drinking. And so I decided, my girlfriend had done a lot of macrame, and she always was so peaceful when she was working on macrame. So I wanted to be an artist, so I went out and bought all this macrame cord and a book on macrame, and they had a 3-foot by 6-foot panel, each square was a foot, and they had different knots for each foot, and I thought, this is a great way to learn it. So I got the pole, and I tied all the cords on there, and I hung it on the back of my motel room door, and I came home from work every night, and I worked on that macrame. And boy, those knots were tight. Sure got out a lot of aggression, but So that was one thing I did. And then I thought, well, this isn't keeping me busy all the time. What else can I do? So I found out that the adult school had ceramics, and I was going to throw pots. This is the end of the hippie era, you know, at the end of 1977. So I went to the, and so I'd throw pots, and I'd come in meetings all covered with mud. And it's no wonder I got the nickname in AA, Crazy Jim. I didn't know what they were talking about. So I was 2 years sober, and somebody from customer service came over to my office and said, you know who you remind me of? And I said, no, who? And she said, Crazy Jim from Taxi. I thought, oh, that's what that's why they've been calling me Crazy Jim. And then a guy from engineering came over 6 months later, and he said, no, you know who you remind me of? And I said, no, who? And he said, Crazy Jim from Taxi. So for 3 years I was Crazy Jim. But weekends were really, really hard. I don't really know how I got through them. I just didn't drink. And I had my hobbies now. I took a oil painting course at COS. I dropped out of it twice. And the third time, I got my picture painted and got an A. My contact with that AA was a strange adventure. I had no idea how you guys were going to keep you sober. But I knew there was something here, some way you did it. And I went to meetings just listening for the secret. The first book I got was the book Living Sober. That was easy. I could use, you know, it's broken down in little tiny chapters, and I could read one every morning. And so it kind of became my prayer and meditation in the morning. And then I latched on to the AA sayings. You know, you hear them if you're around here long enough. I don't hear them much anymore, but live and let live and, you know, all that kind of crap. And I come home at night and I'd write them down, and then I type them all out and put them on the wall of the motel. And I thought that was the program. I thought when you got upset, you ran over to the list and you picked out the saying that was going to work on the problem. And then I had another list. I had a list of all the things I wanted to do when I got sober. And on the bottom of one was go back to church. And my sponsor came in one day. I called him up. I was having a problem of some sort, probably an emotional one. And he looked down that list and he said, I like that list. That's a good list, but don't do that last thing. And I said, what's that? And he said, go back to church. And I said, he was practically an atheist. What did he know? So I said, why not? He said, well, wait a while before you do that, like 2 years. He said, start working on the things you're supposed to work on in AA to get sober. And then once you've done all those things, then think about going back to church. And I thought, okay, maybe that's a good idea. But one Saturday, I had bought a big book. It was sitting on the table next to my bed, the lamp table. One Saturday, I was standing in the middle of the room with nothing to do. And I was looking around the room, and I saw the book there, and my college-educated mind. Now, mind you, I had taken a test once. The result of the test was that I was tested at the genius level. Now, so I got this genius mind and a college education, and I look at the book, and this mind says, I bet I'm supposed to read that. And, you know, I was just doing what they told me. They said, buy a big book. Nobody said, buy a big book and read it. So I sat down that day and I read through the first 164 pages, got a good thumbnail sketch of what this program was all about, and then I started doing it. You know, the first three steps were no problem for me. The fourth step, well, I was going around to meetings, fourth and fifth step, and I was thinking of things that, you know, and I dropped something at this meeting, and I thought I was doing a fourth and fifth step. And I dropped something at that meeting, and I'd say something at this meeting, and I'd say something over here. In my mind, I was doing the fourth and fifth step. You know, I was letting people know about things that I really didn't want people to know about. And So I had a real emotional problem one day, and I called up my sponsor and went over to his house, and the only reason God had appointed him because he could yell louder than I could. And we were yelling at each other, and he was pounding the book he had it open with, and I heard, "You're not doing it like this." I said, "I don't know what made me stop." I stopped and I said, "Let me see that." And he was pounding on the fourth step. And at the beginning, it says, at the top of it, it says, "We get out our paper and pencil." I'd never gotten out of paper and pencil. And I went back to my motel room, and I decided that maybe I was going to pretend like I didn't know anything, like I knew zero. And I'd go back to zero and start using the steps. Now, what I had heard around AA, we had a guy, a Big Bob, he used to say that the steps are like a recipe. If you want to make a cake and you don't know how to make a cake, you go get a cookbook, you follow the directions precisely as they're written down in the cookbook, and you probably come out with a pretty good cake. If you leave out the flour or the sugar or, you know, one of the ingredients in the cake, you're probably not going to get a cake at all, or a very good one. So I knew. And then somebody else kept telling me they numbered them for dummies. Took me a while to accept that one, but you know, so I knew that there they were. I was supposed to do all of them in the order they were written because they numbered them for me. And so I made a decision to do that, but I had a problem with my concept of God. So I went back to my sponsor's house, and he was practically an atheist. And he was in his backyard. He had 32 catfish nailed to a board, and he was skinning them. And I said, "What do you want?" And I said, "How do you understand God?" And he said, "What's that?" And he said, "You know, I understand him because I don't understand him." And I went back to my motel room and thought, what an idiot. What kind of an answer is that? I was sitting there thinking, what the hell do you mean by that? And all of a sudden it dawned on me that God is so immense. I mean, he created this damn universe and maybe several universes more. He's obviously way smarter than I am, and much bigger and much more powerful. And how could I possibly comprehend them with this finite mind of mine? I mean, I couldn't. I can't form a... If I could form a conception within my mind of what he is, then he'd be smaller than my mind. And what that did all of a sudden, I came to realize, and here was this God that was powerful enough to stand between me and a drink. And that's what I needed. So that concept of God became the God of my sobriety. He's the same God I had before, but now he was big enough and powerful enough to prevent me from taking a drink again if I wanted him to do that. And then I took my big book and I went and bought a 12x12. And there were a lot of people in AA back then who didn't talk about doing steps. So this was kind of like a self-help program. So I read through the step in the big book, and then I read through the step in the 12x12, and then I reread the step in the big book and the step in the 12x12, and then I decide what it was telling me I had to do, and then I do it. Then I got to the fourth step. First three steps I really did not have a problem with because I didn't have a problem with the existence of God. And I knew that my life was unmanageable because look where I was living. But I went and bought a notebook. Now, you know, I was assumed I was supposed to do a thorough job. Now, I've talked to people in AA and they don't do what I do, but and some of them do a more thorough job than me. But I went and bought a notebook and I broke it down and I got the notebook dividers, you know, like you do in school. And I felt like a school kid. I was learning all over again. And I divided it. The 12 by 12 suggests that maybe you can't do a moral inventory without any moral standards. You have to adopt some moral standards before you can measure your behavior against those moral standards. So the book suggests you use the 7 deadly sins as a gauge for your, you know, your character defects. So where are they here? Can anybody quote them for me? I have a list of them here, but I've lost the list. That'll teach me for writing them down. But anyway, I made it, set up a section for each of the 7 deadly sins, and then I set up, lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, anger, envy, and pride. Then I set up a resentment chart, just like the book has it set up. And then I had a section for my fears. Then I had a section for my sexual attitudes and behaviors. And I was going to, in the book, when it gets to that part, the book says, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. Well, I certainly needed an overhauling, so I set that section up, and then what I did for 3 months, whenever I went to meetings, went to topic meetings, and brought subjects up during the meetings, and listened to what people had to say, and their experience, what they did, and if I'd done something like that, or things came up to me while I was at work, I'd make notes, and I'd go home, and I'd fill up these sections, and then about 3 months later, I had an old Underwood typewriter. I'm running out of time here, I'm going to have to work fast on these steps. So I typed it all out. It took one Saturday. It took me 8 hours to type it all up and put it in order. I called my sponsor. He said, well, I wanted to take my 5th step. I didn't want to put it off. And he said, well, let me warn you, I'm an alcoholic. If you take it with me, you have to realize you might be taking the risk, because if I go out and get drunk again, I might blab everything you tell me all over town. And you can take it with me, or you can go find a psychologist or a priest or a minister or somebody else who will probably keep your confidence, but you can do what you want. So I said, no, you come over, and I did it. And then the damn book, I was sitting there. I didn't get any real big sense of relief when I did it. I didn't have, what I got was a picture of myself that I didn't like. And I thought, God, I don't want to be this person anymore. And, you know, and what it became was kind of a springboard for change for me. And it was only about 6 months later that I really started feeling like something had happened. But there's a 5.5 step in the book. And it says that we come home, you sit down, you pick up the book, you read it, you go over it, and you think about, did you leave anything out? Well, by God, I left 3 things out. There were 3 things I never wanted to tell anybody about. They covered them in a general way, but these things have led to a lot of guilt in my life, and I'm sure they were part of the reason I drank. And I thought, oh God, do I have to tell those to somebody? Yep. So over a period of time there, I found an understanding person for each one of those things, and I shared it with those people. Now, my sponsor had been right, because something I shared with one of those people, he used against me in front of some of his friends after a meeting one night. So I learned my lesson there. But anyway, the 6th and 7th step weren't a big deal for me either. I knew I had to make changes, and I knew my character defects were the problem. I was willing to have God to remove them. And I asked him to remove them, and the way God dealt with me over the years with those things was he brought me in confrontation with the major character defects, and I had to face up to them, and I had to ask him in all sincerity to remove them, because they were definitely not good for my happiness. And I'm running out of time here. So anyway, the 8th and the 9th steps, there weren't very many people in that, but I had to include institutions, and not only people, but institutions, and like the business I worked for. And I worked my way through those best I could. I didn't make amends to my children until I was 2 years sober on purpose because I wanted to make sure, I was pretty sure I wasn't going to drink again because I didn't want to go make amends and then go out and get drunk and then have to, you know, and then they'd laugh at me. So I left those off for a couple of years. And then I got into the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps, the maintenance steps, and you guys know what those are. And I mean, one that was just daily maintenance of your, you know, your daily inventories to keep yourself in line. And then a spiritual program, working on a spiritual program. These are things you do the rest of your, as far as I'm concerned, the rest of your sobriety, and then helping others. And I won't go over all that because I'm running out of time here. But I think the four things that I had to confront later on, the character defects that God brought to a fore in my life, one was I was really, 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 really angry one night over the fact that a woman I... This was when I was... Oh, no, the first one was... I got married a year and a half sober. That's another funny story, and I don't have time to tell it, but... She had spent 10 years. She had spent 10 years in L.A. on the work in the streets, from the age of 14 to the age of 24, and she'd escaped from there with the help of an older guy and kind of looked after her over those years, and came up to this area. And she had more sobriety than me, and she 13 stepped me. I had nothing to do with it. Anyway. She wouldn't go away after a number of months, and we, you know, we'd break up, and one day she'd been gone for 3 or 4 weeks, and then she showed up at the motel room, and I thought, okay, God, what am I supposed to marry her? So I asked her to marry me, because I thought, God, that's what maybe God's message was, so she wouldn't go away. And she said we had to speak to her minister first. He wanted his approval, so he gave us a compatibility test. And he came back after he graded, and he said, "You are the two most incompatible people I've ever tested." And we looked at each other and thought, he doesn't know what he's talking about. So we got married, which is another funny story. But then 6 months into the marriage, she got into one of these real conservative... Well, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but it's one of those churches where they fight demons and stuff. And she got all involved in that and decided sex wasn't moral anymore. So after 6 months, we couldn't have any sex. And I lived with that for about 3 months. And just couldn't handle it anymore, so I moved back into the Oak Tree Inn. And while I was there, I had to take an inventory on my part in it. And then when she showed up after 6 months and wanted to try a reconciliation, which lasted all of 3 days, I had to make an amends to her. I had to sit her down because I had a part in that. And it was a sexual inventory. Part of the problem was when I was horny, I got very manipulative, and it was a subtle way of applying pressure to get what I wanted. It wasn't any overt, and that wasn't right of me. And I made an amends to her. I took the inventory with a minister in town that I knew took this stuff, because I wanted a rational mind. So many of us in AA are sick in those areas. I didn't want to do it, to take a fifth step with it, because I wouldn't get an objective, assessment. And when I was like sweating bullets to take it with that minister. And when I got all done, he says, "I've heard worse than that." And then he said, "You want to go through a healing ceremony?" And I said, "Sure." So we went into the chapel, he anointed me with oil and said prayers over me. And to tell you the truth, it's never been that much of a problem since then. Something worked. And then I made the amends to her, tried that reconciliation. And then a few years later, there was another person I was having a relationship with, and she was supposed to come over to my... I was living in another dump in Farmersville at the time because I lost my job. And she didn't show up after the meeting like she said, and she called, and I'd been anticipating her arrival because this was going to be the first time, you know, and I hadn't had any for a long time. So she didn't show up, and I just went into this inner rage. And at 2 in the morning, I was laying on the bed, and my heart was pounding so hard, I thought it was going to explode. And I thought, I didn't want to drink. I thought I was going to die. So I rolled off the bed, and I said, God, take my anger away once and for all. And in 5 minutes, it was all gone, and I slept like a baby, and I haven't had a significant problem with it since. And I lost my job. I had to do an inventory on my financial fears. After I got another job, I never realized, after I got fired at once, I never realized I got fired so easily. I mean, you know, I had this other job, and I was scared I didn't have any money left over. So I thought, if they fire me, I'll be homeless again. So I had to do an inventory on my financial insecurities. And 15 years sober, I came to the realization that ever since I was a chronic worrier. I've been a chronic worrier ever since I was a child. So I wrote down a whole list of things I worried about all the time, and I took an inventory, and ever since then, I haven't worried about anything, hardly anything at all. Now, see, I only got through part of my sober log. This is terrible. Why isn't this an hour and a quarter meeting? I have so many more stories to tell. Yeah, come back next week. Anyway, I want to sum it up with this. I work very hard on my program. I still go to lots of meetings. I've held a number of service positions over the years. My relationship with God, I work on that all of the time. I've worked on it very hard over the years. When I retired, I read Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers had said that he had trouble with the spiritual thing, and I didn't have trouble with it, but he'd read through the Bible twice. He'd read through the Quran once, and I thought, well, if Dr. Bob can read through the Bible and the Quran, I can do that too. Plus, I read a book on the Catholic Catechism for Adults, which was like 650 pages long, and I got halfway through the Buddhist Bible. But, you know, I am not narrow-minded when it comes to those things. I have my own specific beliefs, but I just work very hard on understanding other people's spirituality, too, because I can learn from anybody. But here's what... Now, these are things that, you know, one of my fears when I came into AA was, how was I going to cope with anything without booze? Now, just to sum this up real quick, here's what's happened to me over the years. I've had 6 different jobs, 5 different periods of unemployment that lasted about 5 months each. I've had 2 sober marriages and 2 sober divorces. My children deserted me 15 years ago, but I've got my daughter back now. My 2 sons don't want anything to do with me. My mom and dad, younger sister and older sister, have all passed away. I had a falling out with some of my friends and lost their friendship in AA. I've made bad decisions and disappointed people. I've sometimes failed God. I've survived numerous medical problems. I had my first heart attack in 1992. I had a torn retina in this eye and 4 eye surgeries over the course of 2.5 years. I had my second heart attack in 1999, bypass surgery. I've had this artery in my leg rooted out. I've had numerous tests for gastrointestinal disorders. I was told at one time I had liver cancer, but it turned out I didn't. I've had 3 stents, one in my neck, one in my leg, and one in my heart bypasses. I've had my hip replaced and my right shoulder replaced. And, you know, all these things I've been through, AA has been there for, God has been there for me through all of these things, and AA has been there for me through all of these things. And here's the guy that I didn't know how, if I, you know, when I came into AA, my big question was, can I stay sober if this happened? Can I stay sober if that happened? And on with this long list of, can I stay sober if? And don't do that when you come into AA, because God gave all those things to me to show me that I could stay sober. So I wish I hadn't asked the question. So anyway, to end with this, I end my daily prayer with this. I every morning I have my daily, I have a daily thank you list that's 2 pages long. I don't recite it every day. I just hold it in my hands and thank God for everything on the list most days. I study a little in my faith. I have prayers for others in my God box. I have a God box where I pray for others, put prayers for others, and I have my own daily prayers. And I end my prayers with this every day. God, I pray that this day in my life works out just the way you want it to work out. No more, no less. And I pray that this is a good day for you in the life of Jim Kane. That's it.